Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls for this morning. The United States is often said to be the world's most religious nation. At the same time, many Americans say that they think that religion should be a private matter, and that makes for sometimes lively, sometimes heated debate on the role of religion in public life. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking with Martin Marty. He is one of this country's best-known scholars of religion. He is an emeritus professor at the University of Chicago, has authored many books about religion. He is Fairfax M. Cone Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus at University of Chicago, where he taught for 35 years. He will be visiting in Champaign-Urbana a little later this week. He will be delivering the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture in Religion. This will be on Thursday. I'll be speaking on the topic, Because I Am a Citizen, Religion and the Common Good in Today's America. And he was good enough to give us some of his time this morning to give us perhaps a little bit of a preview, but also to talk about some of the issues raised at the intersection of faith and politics, perhaps talking about why it is, it seems that right now, at least, there's so much tension between the personal and the political when it comes to matters of faith. Questions and comments, of course, are welcome. We'd like to bring people into the conversation. You can share your thoughts, ask questions. We just hope that people can be brief, and the only reason we ask that is just so we can accommodate as many callers as possible. Questions, though, questions, comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And there is email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So, as I say, any point in the conversation here you want to be involved, you certainly are welcome to do that. And Dr. Marty, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. Well, again, I should say.
I always enjoy it.
You know, this subject, that is religion and politics and religion in the public square, it certainly never goes away, but it does go in cycles, and it seems to track national politics. And right at the moment, it's a much-discussed issue. So a lot of people are talking about it. I was really struck by actually something that had been written recently by Andrew Sullivan. I imagine you know him.
Yes.
And this was something that people can read in the Daily Beast. And he writes it very passionately and very eloquently, I think, about this issue. And I just like to for people, and it'll give us something to jump off from, to read a few lines from his essay about where he feels Christianity is right now. And here's what he writes. He writes, "We inhabit a polity now saturated with religion. On one side, the Republican base is made up of evangelical Protestants who believe that religion must consume and influence every aspect of public life. On the other side, the last Democratic primary had candidates profess their faith in public forums, and more recently, President Obama appeared at the National Prayer Breakfast invoking Jesus to defend his plan for universal health care." He goes on to write, Mr. Sullivan goes on to write, "The crisis of Christianity is perhaps best captured in the new meaning of the word secular. It once meant belief in separating the spheres of faith and politics. It now means for many simply atheism, the ability to be faithful in a religious space and reasonable in a political one has atrophied before our eyes." What do you think about what he has to say there?
Well, most of it's right to the point. I think haunted by the secular and the non-secular changes in each generation. Secular simply meant of this age, and it used to mean in old England that you had religious priests who stayed in the monasteries and the parishes and secular priests who were out there. And then when we separated church and state, our national symbol says we have a new order of ages, Novus Ordo Seclorum, and they did some really new things. Relative separation of church and state. I use that word relative because we've never done it absolutely. And so it's up and down. I like to quote a conservative scholar of the Constitution, Walter Burns, who said, "The founders solved the religious problem by not solving the religious problem." Many things, most of them did, are very secular. they really avoided, they were really scared of the established church. On the other hand, they were most of them personally pious and believed that piety connected with morality. So that's in our fiber, and it comes and goes.
Well, do you, so I'm sure from time to time people have used this same phrase and said that Christianity was in crisis, and no doubt for, you know, forever and a day, people will be saying the same thing. Do you think that somehow there is something about this moment that is any different from times in the past when people have said Christianity is in crisis?
Yeah, you're right about one thing. It's always in crisis. Crisis comes from the word crisis, which means judgment and means you're being judged and, you know, caught between things. So it always has been. It's been persecuted. It's been a persecutor. But things come and go. But the point of your question, I think, is a good one. What's distinctive about this round of it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's interesting to me is, first of all, you can't sell the players without a program, and there's a lot of switching going on. What we're seeing here, in part, in the rise of evangelicalism, which isn't all far right wing, by the way. I speak at a lot of university campuses where the strongest pro-environmental group will be the evangelical students. They're all over the place on many causes. But in politics, we think of them on the far right. What's interesting to me, when I started writing 50 years ago, I could write about two parties, the moderates or the mainline or the liberals, were what I call the public party, engaged in public life, which didn't always mean political. And the evangelicals and the fundamentalists and the Pentecostals didn't want to talk about this world. We're going to ship you off to heaven. We're going to save you. That's it. We save souls. We're not going to mess up anything else. That's a complete role reversal today. Not that mainline Protestants are out of it entirely, but they don't aspire to it the same way. They don't make news the same way. Whereas evangelicals... last weekend there were huge rallies, some of them kind of fun because there were Tim Tebow and voluntary sector people, but there were a lot of preachers who just plain say, we are going into politics straight and simple, which is against the law, against IRS pattern, but there they are, and they're not quite stoppable. Now, I think that we see there that this is connected to worldwide phenomena. Let's say one more thing about our own. My teacher, Daniel Boorstin, who was Librarian of Congress, quoted Edward Gibbons on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire of a moment that struck him then and strikes me now. It's very appropriate. He said, at that time, there were just so many religions in the Roman Empire, and three things about them. They were considered by the people to be equally true, by the philosophers to be equally false, and by the magistrates to be equally useful. And I think that's what we're seeing here today. Every kind of religion is out there, liberal, conservative, new, old, and thriving in various different ways. And the philosophers, by and large, are the ones usually called secular because they're appraising the world without that religious emphasis. And the magistrate finding it useful, you can be sure that both parties have caught on that it's to their disadvantage to get religion wrong and to their advantage if they can mobilize around religion. So religion is useful, and that's probably dangerous for religion.
Hmm. You know, there the center with which you are affiliated, the Martin Marty Center, has a little feature that people actually can subscribe to. It's a regular piece of commentary. Some of them are by you, and some of them are by other writers, and people can sign up for this, and I believe it comes out a couple of times a month. And it deals, often it deals with the issue of religion and politics. And I know that you wrote a recent, and this is called Sightings, and you wrote a recent piece here, and you note the fact that people often say to you, well, why don't, inviting you to comment on politics or to talk about the presidential race, and you, in this particular piece, write about your reluctance to do that, maybe not. It's not that you wouldn't ever do that, but that you seem to be really hesitant and holding yourself back.
Yeah, well, that's part of my vocation as a historian and a reporter, a journalist, commentator. What I've noticed is that if you are explicitly political, people hear one thing and then that's it. Are you for Obama? Are you for Romney? Are you for Gingrich or whatever? And then they don't hear anymore. I'm not interested in political argument. I'm interested in political conversation. I am personally a rather passionately political person, but not in my profession, because I want to help people think about these things. Now, they can scout it out if they like. That doesn't bother me. But in the 1960s, when we signed up for everything, when I was on everything that involved civil rights, I was a founder of Clergy and Laymen, concerned about Vietnam, and somebody said, you know what, all you do is you cut your congregation in two and you talk to the congregation, but you don't talk to anybody else. So I haven't signed anything for 40 years, I suppose. I'm not less political, but in the area of trying to get people to think about these subjects, like I will do tomorrow night, I don't come on as a partisan, and that's that kind of church identification with partisans often ends the conversation, starts the argument, people get angry, and I'm not sure anybody gets fed or sheltered or anything supposed to happen in the name of faithful religion.
Our guest in this hour of focus is a well-known scholar of religion, Martin Marty. He's the Fairfax Cone Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus at University of Chicago, where he taught for quite a long time, chiefly in the Divinity School, where he established and directed the Institute for the Advanced Study of Religion. When he retired from teaching in 1998, the Institute was rededicated and renamed the Martin Marty Center. He's the author of many books. If you're interested in reading his work, you can go to the library, go to the bookstore. He'll be on the campus later in the week to give the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture in Religion. This will be on Thursday, the 12th, 8 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. It is free and open to the public, so if you're interested, you can stop by. Also, of course, here in this conversation, we welcome people in with your thoughts, questions, comments. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It's something else that Mr. Sullivan remarks on, and certainly other people have, is the noting to the extent to which people in the United States, in response to questions and surveys, like to say that they are spiritual, put that in quotes, but that they don't seem to identify with some kind of faith community. Or if they do, it's in a very loose sort of a way. I wonder what exactly that means, that people seem to want to embrace spiritual values and yet don't hand back from making any real commitment or identifying with a church.
Okay, I'm going to back up, by the way. When I heard you talking before, I made a mistake, and I'm going to correct it now. I said tomorrow night I'm going to lecture. It's Thursday night. I must be so eager to get to Champaign that I've mentally placed myself there already. It's Thursday night. Now, back to the theme. Well, you will often hear in popular culture or at the other end of the bar, I am not a member of the organized church. Mm. I'm not for institutional religion. I'm not even for religion, but I'm very spiritual. And I always say, by that time, it's almost down to an aerosol spray. Spiritual is a wonderful word, but I think when it has an adjective with it, you can do something with it. Catholic spirituality, Jewish spirituality, African-American spirituality, medieval spirituality. But just to say spirituality, that doesn't mean a lot more than if you say, I prefer Handel to Beethoven or something. It's an aesthetic choice, and it means we are in a buyer's market situation. I'm not sure that everybody has to be signed up with organized religion, but I think that the notion that that it'll be pure if I invent it, and I don't get judged by anybody, I don't have to do anything with anybody, is pretty far from what the living spirituality of our centuries has been about. Certainly what Andrew Sullivan wrote about, much of it is true. The churches are often failing to be faithful to what they're supposed to be about, failing the culture. That can all be true, and they need plenty of shaking up. But I don't think they get shaken up by people who, in Jesus' words, shake the dust off their feet and leave the village. I just wrote a book about Dietrich Bonhoeffer recently, who used the phrase for Christians, but it's applicable in different ways for Jews and Muslims, certainly, on the communal character of faith. He said in German, Christus existiert als Gemeinde. Jesus exists as congregation. Jesus exists as the company of people. He's not some ghostly spirit. He's not literally sitting on a throne on his father's lap up in miles away in space. He is present where the prayers are being said, where the activity is going on, where people are throwing out soup for the poor or collecting funds for people in need. And I think when you lose the communal character, you lose an awful lot that goes along the way. So I hope the churches and synagogues and mosques and everybody get their act together. It's not an easy culture in which they can do that because we have such a hyper individualism, if you will. But the power of it usually comes from people who take on each other's burdens, work things out with each other, inspire each other.
Hmm. Well, that's a very interesting notion. I think this idea that what it's really about is community, is being a member of a faith community, and that as much as one could talk, I want to say that when people say that they're spiritual, that they actually mean that. What exactly that means, I'm not sure, but that it's really, it really is about the community, and what happens when people come together.
Well, it's certainly true. For example, today you hear people say, "Have you found Jesus as your personal Savior?" That's not the biblical concept at all. Have you become a part of the ecclesia, the called out people? Jesus is always forming disciples and so on and sending them out too, but they don't make it up on their own. And Judaism is even more emphatic. It's just inconceivable that you find Judaism on your own. Yahweh saves a people, not individual persons. Now, that doesn't suppress individuality or personal life. I think that people who are deeply rooted in community are often the most free to be expressive. They're heroic. They can be saintly. They can be, if they're sinners, they will be worse. But I think you're saved with a people, and you can change which that people might be, and we have plenty of freedom to do that. But I think the notion of doing it entirely on your own all the time is a rough one. Not that there's no beauty in it. I think a lot of people who are spiritual do work it. They get a little bit of yoga. They go to disciplines. They have retreats. I'm not saying they don't do anything, but it's not the same kind of thing as where you wrestle year in and year out with how do you and that community relate to the larger world.
Hmm. Have scholars, I imagine they probably have, spent time talking with people, say you could get together a group of people who would agree with that statement, "I am spiritual, but I'm not involved in a church." And then if you ask them, "Well, tell me what exactly it means to you when you say, I am spiritual." What sort of, to the extent that you're aware that people have done that, well, what do people say? What do they say that means to them?
Well, one thing they would say is negatively, they don't have to muck around with all these foolish people that say one thing and do another, and they're very free. If your spirituality means a walk in the woods, you're not going to be set back by any of those things. If it means listening to Mahler's Ninth Symphony, which is to me a very spiritual experience, again, that's a beautiful thing to do. You sharpen up your tastes. You can even certainly be an ethical person. The community doesn't have any monopoly on that. I don't think. I think you'd be a very ethical person with apart from it. In fact, for my talk day after tomorrow, I use. The title word that I overheard in an NPR interview with a retired physician who keeps his credentials and skills and serves other people without any salary ever. And the interview kept asking him, you know, "Why do you do this?" And finally he just said, "I do this because I'm a citizen." What he's doing is being responsible somehow to the body of people around him. He doesn't say, "Because I'm an American citizen or because I'm a Republican or a Democrat." I'm a citizen. We're part of it. So you don't have to be a person of faith to be the good citizen. You may enhance it by it, but you don't have to be, and plenty of them fail. But I think if you ask the person, you'll usually hear, for one thing, you'll hear from an awful lot of them that institutional religion is boring. And a lot of it is, there are a lot of things you can do about that. Boring because it doesn't move fast enough, and then you go out in the woods and meditate. Doesn't solve everything. A lot of it is also fighting Father Pope and Mother Church, fighting Dad, who gave me an overdose of being born again. An awful lot of it is that. And therefore, they will take some of the elements of what was good about the Catholicism of their childhood or being a Baptist of their childhood and shrug off all the rest. Now, again, on one level, that's part of what reforms the church. You're never supposed to sit back and say, we've got it made now. And I think the church does well when it has articulate critics. I never wake up in the morning worried about the new atheists in America, as it were. First of all, they take care of each other. They all disagree with each other, and that's lively and interesting. Some of them are profound scientists and philosophers, and we can learn from that. That's all to the good. But I think what we have to talk about is where do you go when you're not that? And very few people are articulate about their other belief or their non-belief. But around the world in general, religion is surging. Some years ago, I led an 8-year study of fundamentalisms in 33 religions. And my partner, Scott Appleby, now of Notre Dame, and I used to quote Harold Isaacs in his book, Idols of the Tribe, where he said, and just see how much of this fits in American life today, around the world, there's a massive, convulsive ingathering of peoples into their separatenesses and over-againstnesses to protect their pride and power and place from others who are doing the same thing. And I think that's where the fervent religions in many parts of the world are there. And I think usually when you hear about religion in American political life, it's defined as who the other is. At least we're not Muslims. At least we're not African Americans. At least we're not liberals. At least we're not born again or something like that, which is really a strange way of looking at religion that is mainly what is over against.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Martin Marty. He is a professor emeritus at University of Chicago, has had a long career writing about religion in America. He's the author of more than 60 books. He's won many awards for his work, including the National Book Award. He's past president of the American Academy of Religion and the American Society of Church History, and he will be on the campus of the University of Illinois on Thursday to give a talk. This is the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture in Religion at 8 o'clock on the campus at the Spurlock Museum. Anyone interested in attending should feel welcome. Comments here are welcome, too. My apologies. I think I have a couple of people. Maybe I made them wait too long. We certainly would welcome folks in. You have thoughts, comments, questions. You'd like to share your ideas with Dr. Marty, certainly give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I wonder if I could ask you about something a little bit different. Yesterday on our station, and I'm sure a lot of other stations, on the program Fresh Air, the host, Terry Gross, talked with Tanya Lerman, and she's an anthropologist at UC San Diego, who wrote a book that's titled When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. And she sort of explains that she was interested in trying to, and I think in a sincere way, not a critical way, to understand what people were talking about when they talked about having a personal relationship with God. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that of all of the things that the Protestant Revolution did that were really important, one of the things at the top of the list was telling people that it was actually possible to have a personal relationship with God and that you didn't need to go through any intermediaries. You could do that yourself. Having said that, though, she talks about people imagining talking with God or sitting down and, actually, if you're going to have coffee, pouring a cup of coffee and putting it on the table and that being for God, or thinking that maybe you're going to go for a walk in the park and you're going to sit down on the park bench and really imagining that God is sitting there next to you and that God is there, that kind of presence in your life. And I guess I wonder about that whether that's a metaphor or people do indeed have that kind of very literal feeling that, in fact, in their daily life, God is there right next to them.
Okay. Professor Lerman's book is very interesting, by the way. It's well worth reading. But I think she's only dealing with a segment of what people mean by the, quote, a personal experience of God.
Mm.
She's interested in those, and I've been with them, too. You're driving along, and should you turn left or right, and they pray, and God says turn left or something like that. That's the kind she's interested in. And if you're in that, that's natural. And if you're not, they're simply eccentric or idiosyncratic. But millions and millions in different ways have not only didn't have to be Protestant Reformation. Catholic mysticism was always to have this personal relationship with God. That's why people went to monasteries. That's why they went to the desert, et cetera. Protestant Reformation democratized that, so you didn't have to have the particular channels. But the personal presence, I'm a Lutheran, and if I were Episcopalian, if I were Catholic, if I were all kinds of faiths, we would say that when we are having the sacrament, we are having a personal experience. Martin Luther said the most important words in the issue of the Lord's Supper, when you receive the bread and wine, it says, given for you, shed for you. And you walk away from there with a new sense of the closeness. But you don't go from there and say, therefore, God told me to sign with this team instead of that team, or this stock instead of that stock. That's not the promise. So she does a very good job on those who have that explicit sense, but she doesn't get very far along with what most people have. I was at a performance the other night of the St. John Passion, and many hundreds of people were there, and that music stirs you all the way, and when you walk out of there, you just not just communed with that chorus and with J.S. Bach, but God's presence is there. That St. John Passion closes with a wonderful chorus, which everybody in our family, survivors here, every one of our funerals, that's sung. And to me, that brings all that very vivid to me, but it doesn't make ghosts out of them who can go walk around in the midst of us. I think we have to be very generous in not judging what everybody else means by it. It's very frustrating to be told in advance what you're allowed to experience. But she just took a certain segment of them, and she found them curious, and yet in some ways she treated them with respect.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is Martin Marty. We're talking about faith in America and faith in public life, and we'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with R.A. Dickey, currently the only knuckleball pitcher in the major league.
I've heard it said that a knuckleball is like trying to hit a butterfly in a typhoon. You know, it shakes side to side. It may go straight left.
Dickey has a new memoir called Wherever I Wind Up. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Technology Entrepreneur Center, hosting an invention-to-venture workshop on the basics of technology entrepreneurship and how to commercialize technology from research on Saturday, April 14th at the Coordinated Science Lab. Registration now open. Space is extremely limited. Information at 217-333-1210.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. Here's some of what we'll do over the next day or two. On the program tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, Susan Kundrat will be here. She is a registered dietitian and joins us regularly to talk about nutrition. Celeste Quinn will host. In the second hour tomorrow, I'll be talking with writer, playwright, screenwriter Josefina Lopez. She wrote the highly acclaimed play and film Real Women Have Curves. She's also written for TV and cable networks and has written feature film scripts for some major Hollywood studios. And she'll be visiting the campus, spending some time as artist in residence. She'll be with us tomorrow. And then on Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour, we will welcome here to our studio Andrea Seabrook. She is National Public Radio's congressional correspondent and will be visiting us and will be with us for a day or two. You can check the schedule by going to the website. That's will.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Martin Marty, one of the country's best-known scholars of religion, has authored many books on the subject. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Chicago. He taught for 35 years at the Divinity School there and continues to speak about and write about faith. He'll be on the campus later in the week on Thursday, and will be giving the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture in Religion. That's Thursday. He'll be speaking at 8 o'clock in the evening in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum in Urbana. It's free and open to the public, so if you want to stop by to hear him, you should feel welcome. On this program, questions are welcome, too. We have a caller here ready to go to our line number one. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, hello. Hello.
Yes.
The thing that I had noticed with some dismay is the idea that the U.S. is a Christian country, and it seems to have been almost a government policy to superindo radio, especially public radio, almost philosophic thoughts which are almost Christian in background. Marty, can you mention anything about the Jefferson Bible and how that initial religious thought in our political life affects us now, and also why we should be so set on controlling other people's faith? So, for example, going into pre-American history, the 30 Years' War, where hundreds and hundreds of Protestants slaughtered hundreds and hundreds of Catholics in the Scandinavian countries.
Okay. First, Jefferson. You got him right. Jefferson was a deist, basically. He believed that there is a divine principle, there's a God who sets things in motion but is not really moved by things that we pray for. But he was very impressed by the ethics of Jesus. So he did. It's a little hard to picture a current president, recent president, any president, doing what he did. While in the White House, he got the Gospels, the New Testament texts, and in English, French, Latin, and Greek, all four languages, which he knew well, and he got out his scissors, and he cut out everything where Jesus taught something which didn't have a miracle or supernatural reference in it. I had some students work through the book one time, and they found only one lapse in one of Jesus' parables. Otherwise, it's just a book of ethics, and Jefferson really liked that and didn't like the way the churches were handling it. Benjamin Franklin is almost in the same camp. George Washington, according to one book that I have, used 26 different names for God, not one of them from the Bible. It was never God, the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, never God, the father of Jesus Christ. It was always God, the divine principle, the divine architect, the great lawgiver, or whatever. What's going on? Well, these were very moral people overall. Fooled around a little bit if you're Ben Franklin, but they were basically moral people. They cared a great deal about morality. They liked piety, but they thought it had to be directed toward human good and not toward what they call superstition. Now, they and others took pains in the First Amendment and the battles of that decade not to establish a religion. So I have a whole shelf full of books that are arguing, is America a Christian nation or not? In some ways, by definition, it couldn't be. Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. And if you claim a kingdom for him, you're contradicting. Roger Williams, a great inventor of a lot of church and state issues in America, climbed up the flagpole of Salem and cut the cross out of the flag because he didn't think you should tarnish the cross by tying it down to earthly nations and politics. What I think happened when they took formal endorsement of Christianity or Judeo-Christian or whatever you want to call it, when they took it out of there, they actually did a favor to religion because it put religion on its own, and it thrives a good deal more when it's, I hate to use the word, but it's competitive in a sense. Nobody's there. I've been in European countries where, well, I was in Finland, which is 98% Lutheran, 2% church attendance. Sweden, my wife has observed, says maybe it's minus 2% attendance, and yet you have state churches in most of these places. When they got to the colonies, when they got a nation, 1787, 1789, they threw it on their own, and the people caught on, and you had revivals, you had immigrants. Catholics who came here from Europe were more Catholic when they had to build their own churches and care about it than they were back in the old country where it was all paid for. So I think that's I really think you're getting a bad deal if you want to call us a Christian nation. I think you should say it's a wonderful nation for Christians to act. It's a wonderful way to find the good things in the text. But official Christianity, James Madison liked to quote Montesquieu, the philosopher, who says, if you want to kill off religion, dull it by giving it favor. And I think part of the battle these days is give it favor. I'm not against religion in public life in thousands of ways, but to give it legal priority and to try to make everybody be identified with it weakens it.
Well, I thank the caller for the comments. It's echoed here by someone writing in by email. This question about how you bring your own values to the table and what you expect other people to believe. This listener writes, seems to me that when people talk about the importance of religion in politics or public life, they mean specifically the importance of their own religion. The person writes, I can't imagine some politician who professes, say, a deep abiding belief in the Norse gods being valued as a religious person in the public sphere. Of course, the same goes for more mainstream religions. There's been and is just one Muslim in Congress, for example. The insistence of incorporating religion into public civil realm thus seems to me to be inherently biased. And they were interested in your thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, as I say, Madison was against privileging a religion. He wasn't interested in absolute separation, but he said, we have learned, this is a beautiful phrase, we have learned to draw a line of distinction between religion and the civil authority. And when that line was eroded, you're in trouble. Now, we've never had a Jefferson liked to talk about a wall. I don't think we've ever had a wall. If you think about this, for example, just tax exemption for churches. You couldn't get elected to Congress if you oppose tax exemption for churches. And yet, my hunch is that financially, churches are better off with tax exemption than the European churches are, where they get their tax money headed in their direction. I think most people just say, we're not going to mess with that. The churches do very good things. Religion does good things. The percentage of charitable works, voluntary activities that is religion-motivated through churches and synagogues and mosques, etc., is huge, and we sort of let it go. We let the line erode. But when you come to the point of explicitly mobilizing your congregation, your church body, to support a particular piece of legislation or a particular candidate, in IRS rulings, that's against the law, and people flaunt it, but they... I suppose you have to say, but it's a sin to do it. I'm rather enthusiastic and passionate about the good things that believers can do and do. I don't think the public is ever aware of how many dimensions that goes. I think that's the great untold story of American religion. We kind of know it's there, but different religious bodies, I mentioned the body of which I'm a part. If you just take charitable contributions from everything connected with it, it's larger than the Red Cross. Salvation Army is way up there. They're doing this all the time, and they probably couldn't do it if they had to pay full taxation, but it's a bargain that the nation goes to. So absolute separation is not the same thing, I think, as drawing that line of distinction, which is always changing. But you can always tell when somebody is doing it to encroach on you. Now, this weekend we had a lot of public religion. We had Tim Tebow and we had Bubba, who get up in front of the microphone and tell tens of millions of people, I owe all this to my belief in my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. They both use the same formula, so they're members of probably the same club. They have a perfect right to do that, and if we don't like it, we can turn it off or find a golf club that allows women to support. You can do all those things. It has often produced wonderful lives among athletes, among people in politics, and so on. But it's voluntary. That's the key word.
It's interesting you should bring up the subject of tax exemptions for religious organizations, because I also have an email from somebody who is very concerned about that. At least they're saying that, you know, if as far as they were concerned, that they could preach to politicians as much as they wanted, but it does. They do seem to think that it's unfair that they get the exemption and that they should be as involved in politics as they are. You don't think that's ever going to change?
I don't think it's unfair that they get an exemption, but I think it's unfair for them to be using money gained from that tax exemption to engage in explicit politics. Mm-hmm. You know, in one sense, there's nothing that isn't political in a free republic. Doc Hammarskjöld said, everything begins in mysticism and ends in politics. As you put things, but people who have taste and regard for the other are not going to press it in such a way that the other is ruled out thereby. So I'm very concerned about when we break that line. There are just so many other ways. I'll give you one quick sample. When we were doing, it's called Charitable Choice, and I forget what in the Bush administration what it was called. I was on a commission of Jews and Christians that were studying this, and we found many places it enabled congregations to do wonderful things. I think if you'd see AIDS support, cancer support, homeless support, and you took religious institutions entirely out of it, it would be catastrophic. Not that they do as well as they should, but it's all there. But there's a fine line, and I'll give you an illustration. In our studies, we found an African-American pastor in Mississippi or Alabama who, by everybody's assent and acknowledgement, said he does the best job of anybody at getting young people off drugs and keeping them off drugs. And they praised him, and he said, yeah, but I couldn't do any of that if I didn't get to dunk them under the water in Jesus' name. Well, that's over the line. I'd like it if they're not into drugs, but if I'm a Jew or an atheist and my money is going to get somebody to dunk others underwater in the name of Jesus, that's breaking the rules of the game and breaking the spirit of what works best.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. Just to introduce again for anyone who has tuned in, we are talking this morning with Martin Marty. He's the Fairfax Cone Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago, where he has taught for many years about and has written about and has talked about faith in America. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go on to another caller here in Urbana, line number two. Hello. Yes.
I would like to address this issue of intolerance. So much, many hatreds and even wars has an intolerance, has a religion as its root. And, you know, you go back to the Crusades, you go back to slavery or Jim Crow, even in our time you have this campaign against gays. It seems to have a religious root, and it just seems against the rules, as you say. I'd like to have a comment on that.
Okay, good. I always enjoy speaking of U of I because I get to chat with the people on this program and try to win them by flattering. It's just objectively interesting. Mr. Inge, you have an interesting clientele.
I think so, too, yes.
War. Coincidentally, by the way, I was to give, I think called the Mortensen Lecture for the libraries of your campus years ago, and it happened to be 2 days after 9/11. We had to go to a bigger auditorium because they thought that's what I was talking about. But my title was Religion is the Killer That Heals, and It's the Healer That Kills. And you can't disentangle them entirely. It's the killer that heals and the healer that kills. Why? Because it goes to the depth and the height of human experience, and that's who humans are and what goes on in there. So great peacemaking goes on because of the religions, but your caller is exactly right. Crusades or anything else, it's in war. But I also like to quote the novelist Mary McCarthy, who said, religion makes good people good and bad people bad. And if you're bad and you can do it in the name of God, you're going to be worse. And you can't be a historian of the faith without knowing of the thousands of pages given over to this slaughter and that slaughter. I frankly still see World War I as a Christian war. World War II, we had Japan and everybody else in it. But doggerel, somebody said, Gott strafe England and God save the king. God this, God that, and God the other thing. Good God, I've got my work cut out for me. Almost everybody on both sides, except for Ottoman Turks, were Christian, Catholic, Protestant, or whatever. And they had their clergy and leaders. The YMCA had a pamphlet on how you can use the bayonet on somebody's belly in the name of Jesus and not have a bad conscience. You don't have to do all that, and I think World War II was much better in restraint on that kind of thing. But even we always see it when Shiite fights Sunni, but Christians have fought terribly. The 30 Years' War after the Protestant Reformation, Protestant Catholic, and it still goes on and everywhere. I think what we have to reach here is Abraham Lincoln's famous phrase, we have to reach for the better angels of our nature and see the message of peace to which all the religions are dedicated, and they often spend their time forgetting that.
Another caller. This is line 3 in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Earlier in the program you spoke of the Founding Fathers, and it seems to me they might best be characterized as Christian deists, followers of Christ, the moral teacher and philosopher, but completely denying the divinity of Christ or any other human. And it seems to me that you can understand early American history, at least of the elite, the best when you think of them in this manner.
Yes, you're right. When I was referring to Washington and Franklin and Jefferson, they would be in that group.
May I say that I always find you interesting and stimulating, even when I don't entirely agree with you.
Oh.
I thank you for coming on the program.
Okay, well, I enjoy these chats. I can't resist throwing Benjamin Franklin in here on this issue. He actually supported a revivalist, the Billy Graham of his day, George Whitefield. He said, well, he comes to Philadelphia and the people are better, they talk better, they watch their language, they're more generous. But he said, then somebody asked, are they doing this because of their belief in the divinity of Jesus, and should everybody do that? And Franklin said, I certainly believe in that there is a God. I believe that we will be rewarded or punished in this life for the life to come, or to do good. But he said, as to the divinity of Jesus, he's writing the president of Yale, as to the divinity of Jesus, he said, I find that some people who believe in it are good, and some people who believe in it are bad, and therefore it can't be that that makes the total difference. He said, but I don't usually get involved in metaphysical questions because I'm an 82-year-old man, and I'll soon have a much easier way of finding out about the truth of that proposition about Jesus. He always slipped away and got his point across. Well, I do think there is that. I don't think Jesus is the only great moral teacher. Some people go through and say most of the things he said, as in their morality, you could find in contemporary, whether it's Seneca, philosophers like that. But we forget about them, and I think the larger claim about Jesus is what nags people and keeps them inspired and moves them along the way. I think if we're a Jesus the Philosopher Club, you'd have a little great book society in a few cities, but that would be the end of it. Somehow, wrestling with the proposition that I used in one book on Christian history, somehow all kinds of Christians, South African, Korean, Soviet Union resistance, believe that somehow the human Jesus is the exalted Lord. And they may argue about how they get to that proposition, but it finally comes down to that. And I think if he's only the exalted Lord and doesn't touch this world, you're missing his great passion for the poor and the hungry and the sick. He's very much involved. He doesn't want to just be an exalted Lord up there in the clouds. But if you miss the human Jesus, you're missing a lot to it. It's that funny combination that has kept people busy with him.
Well, we're coming down to we have about a minute and a half or 2 minutes, so and not enough time really to wrestle with this question. But I do find myself beginning and ending with this idea that, you know, to what extent is faith really a personal matter about how I live my life, and how much of this is about my feeling that society should in fact reflect my personal beliefs, and that other people should be living their lives the way I live mine.
Yeah, well, I'll condense because we got 45 seconds now. It's got to be personal. It has to be your appropriation. I quoted Luther. I got to pay him some royalties now. He once said, just as you have to die for yourself by yourself. You have to believe for yourself by yourself. That's where the power comes, and then what you do with it. And there's where I think Moses is told in the wilderness, I am Yahweh. All the definitions of what you want. Jews are very careful about using the word God for it, but that's what's going on. And right away, now, help my people. They're in slavery. Take this new energy and go to the Pharaoh and lead them out. I think that's the combination. Personal experience by itself is interesting, but it has to go somewhere. Collective experience has to be a voluntary gathering if it's to be authentic and powerful and enduring.
Well, there we will finish, but again, mention that a little later this week, this is Thursday, our guest, Martin Marty, will be on the campus of the University of Illinois. He'll be delivering the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture in Religion. He'll be speaking on the topic, Because I Am a Citizen, Religion and the Common Good in Today's America. That's at Thursday at 8 o'clock in the evening in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. It's free and open to the public. In the meantime, if you'd like to sample some of Dr. Marty's writing, he has authored more than 60 books. So you go down to the library, go down to the bookstore, and you can look for his work. And Dr. Marty, once again, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for the opportunity. I enjoyed this.